Welcome to Summit 2014. My name is Tina Chisholm, and I have the pleasure this morning of introducing my good friend, and probably not a stranger to most of you here. I have a few little things about him that you may not know.
Okay.
First of all, he's Canadian by birth, and there he planted two churches. Most of you probably know him because he preached here in Highland, in Abilene, for 19 years. He was also our ACU adjunct professor for 20 plus years. He has visited 52 countries. He preached in 24 countries. I knew him personally because he founded Hope Network Ministries, and he shared an office space with me when I worked in San Antonio, Texas, where he currently lives with his wife, Carolyn, and surrounded by his family, his daughter Michelle, and another daughter Debbie, and a son John. Another son Christopher lives in New York.
Yep.
He has lots of grandchildren and great-grandchildren, which he's very proud of. He also shares something with me, that we are cancer survivors.
Yeah.
So we are very happy to introduce Lynn, but before I have him come start, Caroline has something special to do for him.
It's Lynn's 78th birthday today.
Well, my ear, folks, I can't tell if I'm talking to you. Are we okay back there?
No.
Give us some more juice, tech person. Can we do that? Okay.
Right.
Mariah, do we need more juice?
Yeah.
One other little, since we're talking about benchmarks, like 78th birthdays, this also marks the 60th year that God's been letting me preach the gospel. So, you do the math, I was 18. I had, done some speaking and stuff in a Christian high school, but when I went to Fried Hardeman College the first Sunday, I went with another guy to visit, and he lined me up with a preaching appointment, and I preached pretty much every Sunday since. I call it preaching, but anyway, thank you so much for being here. I have to make a huge apology first. Carolyn and I were going to teach this together. We taught some similar material at Lipscomb back in July, I guess it was, and we've taught this up in Canada, and it was so well received because she was there. Saturday morning, as we got up to get ready to leave, she was literally crying. She was hurting so bad. She had had her surgery on a hip a couple months ago, and it was starting to heal. It wasn't a hip joint. It was just a muscle. And then this started hurting, and a sciatic pain and stuff, and she was just in misery. But I got a text from her that she's in here in spirit, and she's praying for us while we teach. So at least today of the three sessions, her stand-in is her number one daughter, Michelle, who is a wife and mother, and a mother of three and a grandmother of three. She's traveled, since we're going to tell our story today, she's been over a good share of that story. She came into it quite a while ago. I won't tell how many years. I'll talk as if Carolyn and I were talking together here at first. We met at Fried Hardeman University, it's called now. We went to school there for 2 years before we went to Harding. But I grew up in Canada. Are there any other Canadians besides you here? Okay. Viggo Ulrich, I've known all of his life. He didn't have the same color hair when he was a kid. But grew up in Western Canada, and cattle and wheat farm, ranch. Went to a Christian high school in 4 years. And then I was kind of at loose ends. Part of me felt called to preach, and part of me didn't want to go to college, but that sounded better than working on the farm. So it was through a freak accident. I had planned to come to ACU I met somebody who was going to Freed, and it was cheaper, and they would let me in on scholastic probation, and I knew the roommate, so that's where I went. Second year, this girl walks on campus, and I saw that girl, and I told my roommate, "See that girl over there? I think that's the girl I want to marry." I didn't know her name yet. And she was told, someone said she was engaged to a trumpet player, but that was a myth. And anyway, she said yes a few months later. So we've been married since 1957. The first year after we married, we went to Searcy to finish an undergraduate degree at Harding. And right away, I began preaching at the church, little church in Tupelo, Arkansas, where she grew up. She was living in Memphis at that time. The story is, when she was a little girl, they lived about 40 miles from Harding, and most little church, maybe 40 people or so, and most of their preachers were either students from Harding or professors that would come out. And it was always wonderful because they had them at their house to eat a lot, and she loved to hear their stories. And right away, when she was a little girl, she wanted to be a preacher's wife all of her life. Little did she know what she was getting in for. So it was a wonderful thing to go back to that little church to preach. Behind the pulpit, there was a sign. It was a quotation from Matthew saying, "Seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." Seek first the kingdom. Someone had put that up there years ago. Nobody knew where it came from, probably an old gospel advocate. It welcomed worshipers there for decades. When her father used to lead singing, it smiled over his shoulder at those people. And it was part of Carolyn's childhood memories. Her father was killed in a car wreck when she was 13. So it's even more precious because she remembers it behind him. It's on the wall in our house now. That little town folded up, that church faded away, but someone gave her that picture, and it's kind of a treasure. And it's kind of a point of continuity for us. It's what our attempt has been ever since. We went then to Harding grad. Actually, went one more piece of the story. Do you remember what happened in Searcy?
Which part?
The part about you getting born.
Oh.
Our first child, Michelle, was born in Searcy. So then when we went to Harding grad the next year, I'd finished most of the classwork for a master's. I hadn't done the thesis yet. But we were going to British Columbia, Canada. That's on the west coast. Little town called Salmon Arm, way up in the interior, in the mountains, to help plant a church. Carolyn was expecting our second daughter, Debbie, then. And all the belongings we owned, we had in the back seat in the trunk of our 57 Chevy. And we had a little place for the kids to lay on top. No seat belts on there, of course. And we were at Salmon Arm 4 years, and that's where Debbie was born. And then John, our oldest son, was born there, who turned 50 this year, right? And then we came back to finish the master's for 1 year, and I preached it. We were there for 5 years, and I came back to preach at Lepanto, Arkansas, while going to Harding grad school. What do we need?
Oh, she's trying to get me in there.
What's is rattling? Put it down a little bit. Is that better? I won't move. Thank you. Okay. Lepanto. I was raising money for
Let's turn on the other side.
Okay. Is that better?
No. It's her mic. Her mic works.
Her mic works. My work. Mine works.
Okay, we're going to share.
My mic's dead.
Something. Okay, you're going to use this. You're just going to have to hold it.
Okay. I'll just pass it. So, and the minutes are spinning here. So, well, go talk real fast. We were in Salmon for 4 years, four and a half, I guess, something like that.
Hold on.
What is our problem?
I don't know. Trying to.
1, 2, 3. The devil's after us. That one's not on. Is that one on?
This is wrong.
Whoa.
It's still up.
Is it on?
No.
Oh, here comes our tech person. Have you got another mic? Oh, good for you.
I don't know.
Testing. Can you hear this one?
Yep.
Good.
Let's roll. And that volume?
No.
Needs more volume. So, we need more volume here.
Okay.
Okay, we're ready to roll.
Huh?
We need more volume. That's her daughter. I will not be responsible for her taking it.
Can you
no.
hear this one?
Actually, okay. she's a very big perfectionist at everything she does.
Okay.
Now,
okay,
I think we were in a panel of Arkansas. Trying to preach, trying to raise money to go for this mission project. We met sort of an Exodus group together there and also finished our master's thesis. So it was a busy year. And when we left there, we retired and broke and had our stuff loaded in a little trailer. And now we had three kids. Went back to Kelowna, British Columbia, which is out again in the mountains. We were there for 5 years, helped start a church there, and that's where Christopher was born, our youngest. Both those churches are still there, sort of, and they're actually growing again now. And then we got this strange thing about we didn't feel our gifts matched there, so we also, it was a lonely time. We were like over 200 miles from the nearest Church of Christ, 2,000 miles from Carolyn's family, 900 from our family. There were 10 members of our little church that didn't know or like each other very well when we started. But it was going well when we decided we wanted to go somewhere. We didn't know where, but where God wants us to go, except we were not going to come to the Bible Belt in the USA and not going to go to a large church. Well, anyway, we wound up at Highland. And I think they were looking, they were tired of preachers and they were looking for the nearest nun they could get, and I came cheap. So. Anyway, we were there for, that's basically where we raised our kids. Wonderful years. I did adjunct teaching, as we mentioned. I finished the doctorate here. I'm the first guy that got a DMin, the doctor minister from ACU. There were 10 of us in the class. So I was the A, and Andy Sharp was the S, and he was the 10th guy to get one. I just wanted to tell him. And our kids all went to college here. And then the work here, that was a visible congregation. It was a wonderful work, and the church was so good to us. But the church went through some stormy, the whole Church of Christ did, went through some stormy years in the 70s. And the Highland preacher was kind of visible because of Herald of Truth and stuff like that. So our kids heard a lot of stuff at school, and they would come home laughing about it because Carolyn told them that's what you did about stuff like that. And anyway, we got fired actually for a week somewhere in there, but then we stayed for 17 more years, and they were wonderful years for all of us. And those elders took us to raise. But being in the church, being visible, we had a lot of students go there, and that meant that a lot of people were out in churches that were trying to serve churches whether it's elders or ministers, they kind of felt, you know, that was what their, a formative place for them. So they would ask our council, and I kept going on more and more and more to encourage preachers. And somehow in there, my heart just went into, and Carol's did too, what we want to do is to spend our lives, the rest of our lives, God's will being the case, to just encourage and mentor and develop preachers and ministers and elders. So we resigned from Highland, and then we were in Dallas for 10 years, and 5 of those years I preached at Preston Road Church because they were in a bad place, and they said, if you'll come and be with us, we'll help you start your ministry while you're here. Well, new kings arose who did not know Joseph. So when the 5 years was up, new kings said, we didn't say anything about that. So I said, bye. And we launched off. Carolyn made a lot of these decisions. I mean, she had made a lot of these changes. We left there probably the best salary we ever had. And we had no clue where the next month's groceries were coming from. And that was a wonderful, free experience. Well, God supplied, and we did that now for 17 years. 16 years, I guess. No, 17. And we would work with, you know, I would get invited to some place to help. So I would say, well, can you put together a group? Not less than 10, not more than 14. And I'll come and spend 1 day a month with you for 10 months, spread across a year. And we did dozens of those. Several hundred preachers and elders went through. Toward the end, it was more elders than preachers, and usually it was the elders and staff of a given congregation. And, of course, all the time I was trying to do some writing, wrote a few books. But that was a wonderfully busy, fulfilling time for me, and a wonderfully lonely and wearisome time for Carol. She finally raised 4 kids, and got that out of the house. And then she had to all of a sudden manage our books, manage my travel, manage, you know, everything. And so in 2009, as Carolyn would say, there was a pig on the road. We had built a house out in the country. And it was out in the county from San Antonio, and the wild pigs were coming and just tearing up our lawn, flowers, I mean, fences, everything. Well, we tried to shoot them, we tried to trap them, and they were smarter than us. One night I was working on something, and all of a sudden it was like 1:30 in the morning. I thought, oh my goodness, I gotta go to bed. I go in there, Carol's not in the bed. So I thought, maybe she fell asleep on the couch. I checked, no. Maybe she's in one of the bedrooms upstairs. My study was upstairs, it was a balcony outside. And on top of the stairs, I saw something move on the balcony. And I went there and looked, and here's Carolyn in her pink pajamas with this 30-06 with night scope on, waiting for the hogs. And they never came back. She's a pretty good shot, keeps me on my toes. But I told her it was the pink pajamas that did it. So. Anyway, we were flying high in ministry, loving it, feeling like I was 25 again. And feeling like we were right in the groove of what God was designing us to do. And then I needed a little surgery on my neck. They were prepping me for that and discovered there's something else there. We better chuck this thing on your lung. So I get this test, and the oncologist appointment, he says, well, sir, you have adenocarcinoma. And I said, what is that? He said, it's lung cancer. Stage 2, 2B, maybe 3. What's that? Thank you. And our daughter was sitting there, the other daughter, she said, come on, spit it out, Doc. We talk straight around our house. So he says, well, with the right proper treatment and the planets aligned, you might be as much as a 50 percent chance of being alive a couple years from now. And then, you know, he kept modifying that, but that was not, you know, the news I was looking for. So my whole world came to a screeching halt. Surgery, two lobes taken, 3 months of chemotherapy, tough stuff, still a spot. 3 more months plus radiation. And then 1 year of radiation pneumonia. It's fun. And, well, well, there are some funny things happened during that time. You might remember some of the things that happened when I was in surgery.
Well, my dad has an adverse let's see, what was it you were taking? Demerol
or something.
Morphine. And he would see some very unusual things when he was on morphine. And the last time I was with him, spent a couple nights in the hospital, he saw Lego snakes under the bed. But that was okay, because those snakes were adjusting the bed for him. And anyway, but one thing that I wanted to say when he was talking about this was 5 years ago in June, I think is when he had surgery. Well, right before that, he was going to take his granddaughters up to Saskatchewan for a trail ride. And the trail ride, they were going to ride horses, and it was like a spiritual experience too. And, you know, he was going to be riding horses for a week. He was going to drive them up there, take care of them, ride horses. They were going to do the whole thing. And that was 5 years ago, June, and he found out about the cancer and had to cancel the trip. The girls were disappointed, but we had no clue how much life would change over the next year, 2 years. And now seeing longer term, you know, results. This was my dad who was hearty and hale and, you know, fished and ran and hunted and did, you know, so many things that his life has totally changed. Our lives have changed.
Well, when they were starting to do the surgery on me, the last thing, you know, they kind of calm me down and they give you what the nurse said, this is going to be the big margarita. That's the last thing I remember. And the kids said, I woke up singing, Wasting Away Again, Margarita. Oh, man, we had a lot of funny things happen during that time. We don't have time to tell all those. But suffice it to say, you know, all along the way, we've walked with people in ministry through all kinds of heartache and problems. But when we got married, before either one of us was 21 years old, we had no clue about any of that stuff. I'd lost a sister and she lost her dad, but we had met almost, we just didn't know about human suffering, and we've met a lot of it. But we have had a steep learning curve in the last 5 years, especially, well, both of us. You know, God just stopped me. There were a lot of things I needed to learn. I want to zip through some of those in about 10 minutes, so I want to hear from you folks. But, you know, I wasn't still long enough to learn. I learned things I needed to learn to do a task. I wasn't learning the things I needed to learn about the guy that lives under my hat. And I didn't realize what a wife I had. I fell in love with her the first time I saw her. You know, it was all her spiritual attributes that got my eye. But and she was such a wonderful, hardworking mother and companion and partner. But I had no real appreciation of all of that. Our kids were such a blessing. I loved that. I was proud of it. But I wasn't really in tune with it the way I am now. I neglected Carolyn a lot during those years, not the kids as much. But I had to learn, first of all, my own idolatry. You know, idolatry is worshiping false gods, and my God was me. And first of all, it was self-reliance. I can do this. You show me something, I can do this. I can fix this, I can go there. You don't ever say, it won't work if you do it. And I can make any relationship work, you know, the whole Superman thing. But I was a mixture, a real, maybe still am, I'm a recovering mixture of a witch's brew of narcissism and insecurity. One thing elders need to know about preachers is that there are a bunch of us like that. And so I would get my self-worth through what I do best, which what I call my ministry. Especially, I can make good speeches when I was 12 years old. I won a big prize for that. And I learned from the listening to the good preachers how to, a few tricks from them, and I could do that. I spent decades creating a false persona. I wanted people to think that I'm a lot smarter, that I'm a lot better man than I am. And the sick part of it is, so many people believe that. Even to a certain degree, my own family. But God knows better. And He stripped all of the varnish off. Left me naked. Who am I now? Really? And what makes you go now? Really, what makes you do what you do? And how are you going to fix things now? I wasn't even sure I could take care of my future. I mean, I couldn't generate enough income to make it through a year now. Now, by God's grace, I was in remission, still am. By the end of next February, I'll be in the 5-year magic mark. But I couldn't do the kind of work you need to do to generate enough income to live on. By God's grace, we cobbled together enough retirement, and I don't know where that came from exactly, to get by on. But that's no guarantee. A teenage hacker can wipe that out in 30 seconds. But we're not worried about that, because the one who fed the birds of the air has been taking care of me for 78 years. And He's not going to stop tomorrow. And by word about it, I cannot add 1 hour to my life, Jesus said. I couldn't control my own suffering. Now I say suffering, that's my self-pity. But we've gone through some tough times, but many of you in this room have suffered a lot more besides the person who introduced me. I see some faces that are suffering. And so we don't claim to be Superman sufferers, but we've gone through enough of it to know something of what it can do to you, and that's what we want to share. Also, I realized I wasn't in control of anything anymore. Suffering has meaning and purpose, and we'll talk about that some more. But I realized I wasn't in control of things, anything anymore. For weeks, I couldn't get out of bed. Carolyn had to literally make me eat. Didn't want to eat. She had to bathe me. She had to dress me. She took care of everything. And then I got where I could walk. I didn't have much. I couldn't see very well. I don't have very much balance. Couldn't breathe very well. Neuropathy does a lot of stuff to you. Sometimes it makes you hurt for a long time. And there's nothing I can do about that. I can't control that. I can control my attitude toward it. I couldn't, I couldn't hold back death. You know, for the first time in my life, I had what you'd call sort of an encounter with my own mortality, to wax philosophical here. I never, you know, the only thing I thought about dying was that was for old people. Real old people. Always older than me. And, or for, you know, soldiers or somebody, but not. And if I had much death thought, it was fear of death. But I just didn't think about it much. You know, when it comes to death, as Mark Twain said, avoid it at all costs. So there I was, the doctor said 50%. That didn't sound like, you know, a big deal, you know, a good chance. And Carolyn kept waking up in the morning sometimes. She would wake up early and she would see, let me see now, is it, what was it she would say? Is it I that have the cancer or is it he the cancer? And then she'd say, well, we both have the cancer. And we got a note from, some of you know Jim McQuiggan, Brother Jim from Ireland, I love his Irish little throat. Got a note from him, beautiful letter of encouragement, glad you still see the sun shining, the birds singing. And then he said this line from G.K. Chesterton, which I grabbed onto. I wish I could say it like Jim, but it was something like, the greatest sin is to call a green leaf gray. At this, the sun in heaven shuddereth. And I love that line. It's a sin to call a green leaf gray. Well, I would wake up with this thought early in the morning. I've got death in my body. First thing I'd wake up, I'm going to go do X-ray. Well, wait a minute, I can't do that. I'm dying. So I finally kind of confessed that to Carolyn. She's, you know, she wasn't very sympathetic. She said, of course you do. You got death in your body, I have death in my body, so does everybody. But we're not going to waste our, you know, we're not going to spend our, let worrying about dying soon here rob us of the joy of the days we have. We're going to live on the green leaf. And so we do. One more thing I couldn't do. I can't read that clock. Is it 25, Jim?
You got 13 minutes.
I can't make myself significant either. You know, false persona doesn't make you significant. Dressing up fancy doesn't, like Solomon in all his glory. You know, padding your resume doesn't make you significant. It's probably evidence of your feelings of insignificance. So, I feel more significant in God's eyes than I ever have in my life. Even though I have nothing to offer of significance from a human perspective, except the horrible mistakes I've made. But God looks at me and he says, you're my child. You're my beloved child. I made one just like you because I wanted one like that. And so are you. And I had a little word from Van Conwell here that I wanted to read to you. He says, one moment of unconditional love shared in the name of Jesus can call into question a lifetime of feeling unseen, unappreciated, and unfulfilled. Isn't that great? So God has brought us to good places. Did you have something you want to say?
I do. One thing that Dad didn't touch on very much, and I think it's important, or I saw it a lot during this time, was...
Speak more clearly.
A great struggle with faith. he didn't touch that on that much, but I can remember being in the hospital, sitting by his bed at home, and him saying, not exactly why me, but why? And I could see that in his eyes. I could see the struggle that he was having, trying to figure, make sense of this all. And I think it was the first time that he really came to grips with some questions that other people had come to grips with and probably asked him how to deal with those, and he had never dealt with them. And I think we all dealt with that. Why? Why does God allow this? Why me? Why pain? When you have pain every day. And I remember sitting and thinking, I was so glad that my mother and father had instilled a strong faith in me, because it was then I felt like I could say and be some of the things. Maybe not in words actually so much, but in just being there, just trying to calm their fears. Still get to do that lots of times, and I love it. I get to pay back now, but he may have some more to say about that, or you may have questions about that.
I want to open up to questions in just a moment. I did want to say, I wouldn't want to go there again. It wasn't much fun, and it isn't much fun, but I thank God every day that he allowed me. I don't think God did this. I thank him every day that he allowed me to go through this experience because of what he's teaching me, us. It was harder for Carolyn. I wish so much she could be here. You could ask her questions today. But she was the one that stuck with all the decisions, all the responsibility, all the hard work. And in the middle of this, between my two chemos, she had surgery on her knee, on her foot, and she had to go around the house on a scooter and crutches and a walker and so forth, hauling me back and forth to appointments, which were, you know, several times a week. We ran through like 16 doctors in this whole deal. So it was hard for her too, but it's been a good thing. Now, as Michelle said, I don't know that I ever asked the question, why me? I think it was a little different form. It was not why not, it was why not me. I mean, Carolyn and I didn't feel that we qualified for any exemption from suffering. But it was why suffering? Why does, you know, what's going on in the world is just such misery, and you see people suffering 10 times worse than us. They have for years. Glenn Pemberton, one of the professors here, written a wonderful book you want to read, maybe. It's called After Lament, Learning to Trust Again on the Psalms. He is in chronic pain that's almost unbearable 24 hours a day. Why? Well, we'll talk about that a little bit more maybe tomorrow. Do you have some questions? Maybe we've got about 5 minutes left, 8 minutes. Question for Michelle, because she won't be here tomorrow. She's got to go to work. Well,
we answered all their questions.
Those are real people sitting up there, aren't they?
We answered all the questions.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
To be able to differentiate clinical depression from a solid, good, healthy, spiritual depression.
Thank you for the question, and I really would. The question is: can you separate being depressed from clinical depression and spiritual depression? In one way, I see those as three different things. Both Carolyn and I have had periods of clinical depression in our lives, and so we know what it is. And it's not just having a down day. You can't just pull your bootstraps up and go. And for people to accuse someone in clinical depression of having a bad attitude or being in a bad spiritual place is unfair and hurtful. Is that right? But you can be depressed. Everybody gets depressed now and again. get tired, your metabolism's off, you know, whatever, and you feel down, you know, that's a different thing. And sometimes spiritual depression I see more in terms of what St. John of the Cross calls a dark night of the soul. When we feel far from God, sometimes it is induced by suffering or bad things, but sometimes it's just most of us hit walls, right, in our spiritual walk, where it just seems like, well, I felt this way about one thing in that period. All of my life, Carolyn and I have been trying to help people who are suffering, trying to empathize with people who are suffering. But as Rabbi Abraham Heschel said, the man who has not suffered, what does he know anyway? You know, I didn't know what it felt like to suffer or look at death. And sometimes I would feel during that ill time how inept and inappropriate I've been to so many people who are suffering, because I didn't take time to think. I do know there's a difference between being depressed, spiritual depression, and clinical depression. Clinical depression is treatable, but not by pulling up your bootstraps. Usually treatable. Yeah.
Having been on both sides of suffering, as healer and sufferer, you both kind of been there.
Caretaker and sufferer.
Yes.
Are you a physician? Or?
No. So, to-dos and not to-dos. As somebody who's tried to help and someone who's been there.
You're stealing our thunder for tomorrow and the next day. One thing I will say, this is Caroline right here is a friend of our granddaughter, and she had become our adopted granddaughter. She graduated from Maine. She was one of the sing-song hosts two years ago.
Last year.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, she'll be at the back with some handouts. One of them is a list of books we found a great deal of help from. We'll talk about that tomorrow. So, and one of the books that's not on the list you might want to write down is Max Lucado's book, You'll Get Through This. It's a series he preached last year, I guess it was at Oakville, but it's a wonderful book on this very subject. But we're going to talk some about ministering to caregivers as well as being a caregiver. Is that what you meant?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we got time for one more question. It's a short one. Speak it out loud.
For you to not question, or how did you process through as you walked alongside that?
Are you talking to Michelle?
To me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just restate the question.
Okay, what she's asking is, what did I draw from? How did I get what I needed to walk through mom and dad through this? And I would think, I would have to say that wasn't any one thing at that time. It was more mom and dad's faith. They've had faith struggles. My dad's written books about faith struggles. I've read them. I walked through them with him. But I think one of the things that they've given me and that God's given me is, sometimes I have questions for him, but he has become over the years, and as I'm sure, I think more of a person to me, more of a part of me than more out there. And I think that's really what helped me, is just having that foundation already in place. There's some good books, there's some great things, but I was, you know, blessed in having that foundation in place. So when it came time, and maybe also I'm as stubborn as they are too, so I was just going to hold it together. And my brother and my sister were just going to hold it together. But I think it created lots of questions in us too. But I think for me personally, just having that solid foundation, I don't know what I'd do without it. I really don't. Not everybody is blessed that way, but if you can build that in your kids, you know.
I don't know if you're implying this, Liz, but if there's if there's a point where people who are congenital doubters come to the place where they never struggle with doubts, I have no idea where that point is. But that doesn't bother me anymore either, because I've come to see that as, at least for me, normal. That doesn't change who God is or what he thinks of me. And the same is true about, you know, what's the advice for caregivers or for sufferers. All I can give is our experience, and that's one take. She's her oldest granddaughter, Sheldon's oldest granddaughter, her name is Shiloh. She's second grade now. But when she was about four, they were playing with some kids out by the pool, neighborhood pool, and a little Hispanic girl that could only speak Spanish. But you know how kids will do, they were connecting and playing and jabbering to each other in English and Spanish. And finally, the little girl said some stuff, and Shella got around in front of her, and she said, "Friend, I don't understand a word you're saying. I don't speak Spanish. I only speak Shiloh." Well, the facts are, that's all any of us speak. You know, to say, this is what the Bible teaches. This is what my understanding is of what the Bible teaches. Yeah. Best we've got. This is only my experience. And it may not be yours at all with suffering. There are some universal things that are helpful to each other, but they're not. Well, my clock says it's time to go. Maybe we'll have a few extra minutes tomorrow. We got all our tech problems solved. Thanks to our granddaughter, Mariah. Thank you, Mariah. And thank you. You might want to head out there right now to catch a movie.